Welcome back to Palisade Radio. This is your host, Tom Bodrovic, and joining me today is Gregor Gregerson, returning guest for several times. How are you, Gregor?
I'm good.
Gregor, you own a silver bullion dealer, well, silver and gold bullion dealer in Singapore, silverbullion.com.sg and the safehouse.sg. Could you give us your thoughts on what is going on with silver right now?
Yeah, so what we're having with silver is something we've seen three times before, 2008, 2011, 2013, and now in 2020. And essentially what's happening is that silver prices are collapsing. And that's driven mostly by the financial system as a whole, basically deleveraging, meaning that there's a lot of people which were borrowing money to buy stocks. And now that the market is crashing, they're getting margin calls and they're forced to sell everything they have. So there's quite an indiscriminate sort of selling. People will sell their gold, their silver, and so on and so on. So that's pushing down the price of silver. And that's essentially the effect. And you have to remember, if you're looking at the amount of margin at the New York Stock Exchange, it was about twice that we had in 2008. I was talking about that many times. So, you know, when the market starts crashing, it's going to crash a lot because of that. And silver basically is from a paper point of view, is one of the victims of that short term.
So as we see the paper price of silver crashing, what does physical demand in silver look like right now, and what kind of premiums are you guys seeing?
Yes. So we've been telling the narrative essentially that you want to buy physical gold and silver because it will be very important to have in a crisis. And we are now heading into a crisis. So why is silver crashing like this? It is because in the paper markets, people can effectively, if you have $100,000, you can have a 10 times leverage, and you essentially sell $1 million worth of fictitious silver, which doesn't exist, but you sell it on the market and you create $1 million worth of sales pressure. Now, if you are a guy who wants to buy physical silver or gold and you have $100,000, then you just spend the $100,000 to get the silver, and the dealer might hedge that position in the future exchanges. So that would mean there's $1 million worth of downward pressure and $100,000 worth of upward pressure, which means that there's a $900,000 net pressure downwards. So essentially what I'm trying to say is that the price of silver and gold, at least right now, is not being determined by physical supply and demand. It is determined by the future exchanges, which essentially are just money pushers or bankers or speculators, which for whatever reason are needing to sell right now or are looking at profiting into it, because silver is a relatively small market. So that's essentially why the price of silver is not really correlated well with actual supply and demand. And what we are seeing here on the physical side is that our sales have been going up by about 600-700%, in some cases even more than that. And the industry as a whole now is starting to have a lot of trouble getting silver. I can give you an example. Our supplier, when you're buying metal from the Royal Canadian Mint, the Royal Canadian Mint normally produces at $1.50 per maple leaf. And by the time we get it down in Singapore with shipping and things like that, it becomes 165. But all of these sales are going through a set about five distributors, very large distributors, which are handling the shipping and so on. And they just raised the prices up to $4. And every day it seems to be going higher and higher because the metal is just under such big buying pressure and supply just cannot keep up. The US Mint has already announced that they're not taking any orders anymore. Royal Canadian Mint will typically will follow suit after a few days. So that might happen in the next few days. And so essentially, it's getting harder to get bullion. And so we are seeing an increase in the premium. So while the price of silver has been falling to about $12 right now from 18, the premium at which silver is being sold has gone from, in the case of coins, for example, maybe $1.90 up to what probably now is $6 or so. So when you're trying to buy physical, you actually have a much higher premium nowadays. And what we're trying to do to counteract that to some degree is to increase our sales or buyback price. But there's some issues with that, because if the only dealer who does it, then it becomes a bit complicated. But that's essentially the situation.
How do you see the silver leverage, the silver value leverage versus gold?
Yeah, so the gold-silver ratio, I mean, I believe we're going into unprecedented territory right now. We are at, last time I checked, we were at 122, meaning that it takes 122 silver coins or silver units to buy one unit of gold. The natural ratio between gold and silver is 15 to 1, 1.5. So throughout history, it always used to be 15, 16 to 1, gold versus silver. It only changed in the 20th century. And we ended up having this range where silver would bounce versus gold between 50 and 80. And the rule is that if you're close to 80, you should buy silver or switch into silver. And if you're close to 50, you should switch back into gold. So right now, we are at over 120, which means that silver is extremely cheap. And I think that's also one of the reasons why we're having so much demand of people wanting to buy the physical silver, because the physical buyers tend to be aware of this ratio and how cheap silver really is. And it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that, you know, when you have a good which is becoming cheaper and cheaper and demand becomes higher and higher, you're going to have shortages. And the very fact that the price of silver is getting cheaper means people can get more silver for their money, which makes this all worse. And on top of that, we have the coronavirus, which has shut down a lot of the plane routes worldwide, which means it's also becoming harder for the logistics of getting silver. So all of these things are essentially coming together. Gold is a bit easier, because it's so much smaller, to essentially make silver a very, very good deal. Basically, all of my personal money is in silver right now, not in gold.
Do you think with the virus affecting everything as it has, that the industrial demand for silver will be going down? And is that going to affect the price negatively, the paper price?
So the paper price is all dependent on the expectations of traders and analysts and, you know, these sort of people. So it sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy to some degree. But since there's a reality of supply and demand, so to the extent that people care about the reality of supply and demand, it's not going to have a big impact, because silver is a metal which you cannot really substitute for other metals. And despite the coronavirus and so on, Intel will still have to make the CPU chips. Apple will still be producing chips. The solar panels are still going to be made, and so on and so on. And, you know, also look at it this way. Silver is actually one of the most powerful disinfectants out there. So from that point of view, you can actually see an increase in that sector. Now, how it all plays out, I don't really know. But if you add the numbers, silver has a very inelastic demand, meaning that people will keep on buying it no matter whether the price is going up or down, because they need it. I don't expect to be any huge disruptions. If they are, it will just be short-lived. And but whether they are or not, you know, whether it affects the price, that's really just based on the expectation of the traders. But long-term, I don't think it will matter. And I think the price of silver right now is just incredibly cheap, because once you use inflation to adjust these numbers, you know, silver is one of the lowest points in an extremely long time.
Absolutely. What are some of the risks to consider when storing bullion?
It depends what you're worried about. Now, what we specialize in is what we call systemic wealth preservation. And systemic is the key word here. What we essentially are saying is that when there's going to be a really bad crisis, and potentially we might be entering into a really bad crisis because the coronavirus might kick off some other ripple effects in the economy, then it pays to store the silver or gold in a jurisdiction that is different from your own, in a jurisdiction that is safe and well-trusted and wealthy and well-defended. Typically, nowadays, there are only two jurisdictions which sort of fall under that category, either Switzerland or Singapore. And I would argue Singapore is a better one between these. So when you do store it, if you decide to store it offshore in a safe jurisdiction like Singapore, then the next question becomes, what about the counterparty? Who are you storing it with? Now, you have to worry about two factors. You have to worry, is that counterparty itself reliable? And oftentimes, you know, you can look at the history, how long they've been around, but maybe more importantly, what type of insurance do they have? So that's why we are making sure that we probably have some of the best insurance you can get in the industry, including mysterious disappearance. But the other very important factor, which is why we decided to build the safe house, meaning our storage facility here in Singapore ourselves, instead of outsourcing, is the jurisdictional exposure. And what I mean with this, if people, say in the United States, are worried that there might be a repeat of the gold nationalizations of 1933, then you would want to store your gold in a country which is not the United States and with a company which does not have to follow US law. Because if you're storing it with a global operator which has, you know, a lot of business transactions in the US, or you're storing it with a bank which by default is beholden to US regulations, then these entities are going to follow US law no matter what. And if the United States is going to nationalize gold and you're storing your bullion in Singapore, that bullion is going to go straight back to the United States and you're going to get some US dollars as part of that nationalization. And if you're looking at the storage contracts, they already have clauses in their force majeure clauses, which essentially states that any confiscation or nationalization by any government anywhere, you have to indemnify the vault operator against. So that is the standard in the industry, and we did not want to follow that standard. We wanted to only be beholden to the Singapore government and no other government, and that's why we built the safe house. And so that's a core pillar of this idea of systemic wealth protection, that you don't store your gold with somebody who's beholden to the United States or to the European Union or anywhere else other than the Singapore government, because you always have to trust your wealth to some jurisdiction, and we're just making sure that it indeed is only that one jurisdiction. And so if you care about these things, these are things you should, you know, watch out for. Another issue is there should be a way or a guarantee that gold is real, that it's not gold-plated tungsten. And you want transparency. You want to be able to ideally see it, have photos. You want to be able to make audits at will. There should be an auditor coming once or more per year, a well-known auditor to do audits of physical bullion. In our case, it's Ernst & Young, as well as Bureau Veritas. And lastly, I think you would want to make sure that you are actually the legal owner of the bullion instead of just being owed the bullion. And that can only be done if you're buying full bars. You cannot have partial bars. You have to buy full bars. And those will be sold to you through an invoice, which then under the jurisdiction of Singapore will make you legal title owner of that physical bullion, which then of course means that every bar you have has to be by serial number, and you have to have paperwork showing that you actually bought that bar. If you have all of that, that's about as safe as you can become, because you'll be owning private property in the form of gold, and you're just storing it with somebody who provides the storage, insures it, and provides liquidity for you. So those are the type of things that you can do to make sure your gold is really safe and not have any ugly surprises when things get tough.
Absolutely. So let's say we store some bullion with you, and once this crisis has passed, the price of silver and gold both go up. How do you make sure that there's enough liquidity at, let's say, the top of a market to be able to buy back all of the bullion?
Yes, maybe let me preface for a moment. I think that, you know, at the beginning of a crisis, gold and silver will go down. It did so in 2008, for example. But if the crisis becomes really bad, it will go way up. You can see examples in Greece and other places where gold was trading at 50 to 100% of the official spot premium. But because Greece is so small, you know, the spot price itself wasn't changed. So it will be extremely interesting if this crisis really becomes bad, how things are going to play out. If things go really bad, we might have a default of COMEX and the future exchanges. And then essentially people holding physical gold or silver will probably see a huge price swing upwards. If we see a currency crisis where people don't trust the United States dollars anymore, then gold and silver will, you know, become extremely valuable in dollar terms. So I just wanted to put these things down. The crisis doesn't have to get better for gold and silver to go better. I think you're going to see the really big spikes if the crisis becomes a lot worse. Now, having said that, how do we create liquidity? During normal times, we essentially buy our bullion from a refinery, or in some cases for some products like Royal Canadian Mint, through some major distributors. Now, as a company, we have about $15 million worth of Singapore dollars. So in US dollar terms, about 11 to 12 million US dollars of net assets, which we keep in physical gold and silver. And we have no debt whatsoever. Of that money, maybe a couple of millions or so, we are keeping as cash in order to support buyback liquidity. And when somebody is selling back, say, a $5 million worth of gold, what we will do is we'll buy $2 million worth of that ourselves, and we'll be selling $3 million back to our supplier. We normally get that cash within 2 days, and we pay the customer within 2 days of that. Very worst case, 5 days. So that's how it works. Now, when somebody sells back, that price will normally be below spot, and we'll be selling it back as well, slightly below spot. And, you know, we provide those funds. What's happening now, so, is that prices have been of premiums have been going up so much. So, but bullion dealers, refiners are still buying at spot price, and distributors, they raised their selling prices, but they didn't sell their buyback prices. That's why you're seeing the spread going up. And what that essentially means is bullion dealers will have to make a decision. If I'm going to get that $5 million buyback, I can absorb $2 million and I can resell that at high premiums. But what about the extra $3 million of that buyback? If I sell it back to my supplier, he will only pay spot. You see what I mean? Which is why there's a reluctance by many bullion dealers to really increase the buyback price of gold and silver premiums much above the spot price. And what that then essentially means is that for a customer who wants to buy gold or silver, especially silver, they're seeing the price at which he can buy silver go up and up and up, and the price at which he can sell it back not really go up by much. And what I'm wanting to change in the industry, or sort of the voice where I'm trying to tell and send that message out, is, hey guys, if we should not always rely on spot prices when there's a market crisis like this. If we are selling silver at a $5 premium, then of course we should be buying it back at least a $4 premium. And that is something that most dealers right now are not yet willing to do. But that's something I'm pushing for, because I think it's important that we start having physical bullion-based price that is based on supply and demand, and not just captively controlled by essentially future contracts, which, as I mentioned earlier, don't really have much reflection of the buy and sell price. So, that's pretty much where we are now. But the other good thing about, the thing in a crisis is physical bullion is basically in very high demand. And even so, buying it back at $3 or $4 is not really a problem in my mind, because you can always sell that to people who want it. You can even sell it at a competitor at a higher price. It's just they themselves are too scared from a procedural point of view to really go much beyond that spot price. It's a psychological sort of barrier that we sort of need to overcome in the bullion industry, in the bullion dealer industry.
Do you have any strategies or thoughts on how to get other bullion dealers to cooperate and adopt your mindset?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, if I do it and others don't do it, I will probably get most of the buybacks, because the market is being disrupted and you cannot get any silver. I will continue to have silver and be able to resell it and be able to trade when the other bullion dealers cannot. So what I'm doing really is a rational thing, which the other ones should be doing. It's just they're not seeing the rationale behind it yet. So I believe that it's all a matter of how long the crisis lasts. If this crisis becomes worse and the supply of silver and to some degree gold continues to be difficult to get or becomes worse, then it just seems natural that bullion dealers will shift more towards an exchange kind of system, where instead of just looking at it from a centralized distribution system, where customer selling back is a small part of the business, we'll be looking at it at customer selling back being really the main source of all the bullion. And once we do that, we can have a price which is based much more on the physical supply and demand and detached from the spot price. And if the crisis becomes bad enough, then maybe we're even going to see a default in some of these future contracts, in which case it's going to push even more in that direction. So I think it's just a natural progression, and the main determining factor is simply how bad and how long is this crisis going to be. And maybe one more thing to point out is that future exchanges, if a future exchange is supposed to be the connection between the physical commodity and the paper price, in the case of silver especially, and to some degree gold, you cannot take delivery of more than a certain quantum of silver or gold per month or per quarter. So if I remember correctly, on average, a future exchange only has 2% worth of gold and silver backing it. So if suddenly a whole bunch of contract buyers were to ask for delivery of that gold or silver, the exchange would not be able to handle it and would technically default. To prevent that, the exchanges put a lot of rules in place to prevent the delivery of silver, especially to investors. And the rules typically state that industrial users will have preference, and only whatever is left will be allocated to investors in times of, you know, high demand for redemption. So it comes back down to the same thing. It's all about psychology. If the market is going to feel that we need to have physical gold and silver because we don't trust our counterparties, we don't trust the banking system, then that demand is going to cause a lot of pressure on exchanges, and people are going to realize that they cannot get physical delivery, and that the prices traded at the spot, in these future spot prices, cannot give you some metal, especially if the bullion dealers are not willing to sell at that price because they're already putting a much bigger premium up. And once people cannot get physical metal at the spot price ceases to be useful. And then you need a new market price discovery mechanisms. And why not have the bullion dealers do such that, which are the very ones which tend to buy and sell the physical metal? So that's essentially how I think it's going to play out. It's all a matter of, are we going to solve this crisis quickly and everything will come back to normal? In which case the gold and silver will probably start going back up, but the premiums will come down. Or will we see the premiums keep on going up higher and potentially the spot price becoming less and less important in pricing gold and silver?
Some excellent points there. Before the call, we were talking a little bit about life in Singapore right now. How are things in Singapore and your recent trip to Italy, if you could contrast the two?
Singapore, as you might know, I chose to move to Singapore in 2007, essentially because I was just sort of fell in love with the way Singapore is run, the government. It's just an amazing place. It's a government which believes in pragmatism. It doesn't believe in some economic or doctrine or something like this. It's just basically saying we do what makes sense for our people long term. And if we are doing it a way which isn't that good, we'll just find a better way of doing it. So, and this sort of, you know, policy and this attention to detail and so on, it's also reflected in the way Singapore is dealing with the coronavirus. And, you know, you might know the World Health Organization many times stated that Singapore is sort of, you know, the example way of how to do everything. So what Singapore did when the virus first came out, very early on, they said that we will block Chinese citizens and people who have been in China for the last 14 days to come into Singapore. But, and then other countries have copied that. But you have to understand that the reason Singapore did that is, or why they blocked Chinese citizens, it's not because they were Chinese, but it was because if you're a Chinese citizen, you don't get a stamp in your passport when you are in the country or you leave the country. Just like any other citizen. If you're a US citizen, you don't get a stamp when you go to the US. You go get a stamp when you go somewhere else. So that meant that upon immigration, the Singapore government did not have a way of telling when a Chinese citizen was last in China. And it all came down to checking that passport and making sure that the person has not been in China over the last 14 days. And because they cannot do that with Chinese citizens, they just made a blanket ban on all Chinese citizens coming to Singapore. So the lessons here, though, is it's important to check the passport. Now, what Italy did is they sort of said, okay, we're having this coronavirus in China. Why don't we just cancel flights from China? So when you cancel flights from China and you're living in China or you are in China, you want to go to Italy, guess what? You don't take the Beijing-Rome flight. You take the Beijing-Frankfurt flight and then from Frankfurt to Italy. Or you go over Istanbul or over Dubai or some other flight. And those flights were okay. They didn't block these flights. And the critical part is they never bothered to check the passport. When I flew to Italy, and I've done so in late December and again quite recently in February, they never checked my passport if I would have been in certain countries. So the policy of blocking flights from China is completely useless. It is an example which I think, unfortunately, in the Western world, we're seeing over and over and over of essentially incompetence. Our governments are doing things to give an impression, to kind of show, oh, we are doing something. But it's being implemented or handled in a way that doesn't necessarily have any real value or protecting anybody. And so that's what happened in Italy. They never really blocked anything. And they just kind of went on life as usual. And the thing about the coronavirus is they think that they're about 8 to 9 people which have the virus for every one person being discovered. And once you have a certain amount of people in the country, then essentially it's very hard to block it. And you go past a certain point, you essentially have to switch from the idea of containment to just the idea of managing it. And when it comes to managing it, the matter that's important is how good is your healthcare system? How many ICU stations do you have? Because most people, they're not going to be affected at all. A lot of people don't even have symptoms. So it's only that 5-7% or so which is going to get into trouble. And when these people get into trouble and you don't have enough beds, that's when things become, you know, really problematic. So in Singapore, the government basically blocked it very early on. And did testing, did risk assessment, did tracing and so on where people are. So they managed to pretty much identify the spread of the disease, and they limited the number of cases. I believe in Singapore we had 190 cases or so. And as far as I know, we've not had a single death. So nobody died in Singapore off of this. But the government, being as pragmatic as they always are basically saying, look, if this virus is going to spread worldwide, we won't be shutting down Singapore. No country can shut itself off completely. We'll just have to live with the fact that the virus is going to become quite common. And what you have to understand about viruses like this is that early on they might be quite virulent, but over time they kind of tend to become weaker. And if you take our flu virus, there are actually 5 or 6 different viruses which we've been living together for a long time. And so I think the coronavirus will just join these flu viruses and we'll have 6 or 7 instead of 5 or 6 viruses. So it will all sort of play out over time. But the way government manage the amount of infections and the way they prepare for it with the right medical supplies and so on, that's very important. And Singapore is top-notch in these things, which is why we've had so little damage in some ways compared to what's happening in Italy, for example.
Some signs of hope there for sure. Is there anything else on your mind that you're looking at right now?
Well, we had the health minister in Singapore, so he was on interview on CNBC. It will give you a very good idea if you watch it on the response in Singapore. But he was saying it's not going to get better anytime soon. You should expect this crisis to last for at least 1 year. That's what he's saying. Whatever policy you do, whatever lockdown you do, you have to think about the long-term effects, because even a lockdown is not going to make the virus go away. All you can do is to basically reduce the number of infections and the number of ICU cases to spread that curve out more. So it's just good to have a realistic picture, basically. And I guess we just sort of have to go through. I think a lot of people will get it, and a lot of people might have it and might not even know right now. But I think that in many ways, the psychological damage and the fears that it's creating and some of the lockdowns which we are making and so on might be worse than the virus itself. So I don't know how it's all going to play out, but I think while it was in China, nobody seemed to care, and the stock markets ended up making new all-time highs over and over. And suddenly, that virus has starting to spread in Europe, and you know, everything, the whole psychology is changing completely because now it's on our back door. So I think before it was just underestimated by far, and right now we just have to be careful not to get too worried about it, because it is something which is going to play out, and the mortality is very low. People at risk, of course, you know, they're not gonna, they're still in trouble if they get it, but overall, this is not something like the Black Death. Overall, this is something which is going to test the healthcare system. And in some ways, it might also be a warning shot across the bow. It's sort of telling us, hey, we can really have some really bad viruses coming in the future, which might be a lot worse than the coronavirus. And we better get prepared for it. So the fact that the coronavirus has a very low fatality rate, in a sense, is quite a saving grace. And if it craves, and if it makes everybody more prepared and aware of these sort of things, then that might end up being a good thing.
Absolutely. If anybody has any questions or comments about today's show, please email me at tom@palisaderadio.com. Gregor, thanks very much for your time today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Think you understand the junior mining sector, and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?